Nearly all writers attempting an interpretation of the Osirian cycle have recourse to Plutarch. It has seemingly never occurred to Egyptologists that this eminent priest of Delphi might have purposely confused or distorted the fable, or, if not that, might certainly have misdirected the attention of the reader from relevant to irrelevant explanations. Two factors must certainly be taken into consideration when reading Plutarch. First, he was an initiated priest of the mysteries. Of this there can be no doubt. For he himself says, quote, "For the mystic symbols are well known to us who belong to the brotherhood," unquote. And in those days it was known as the Brotherhood of the Snake, and those who possessed the knowledge of the secrets of the ages wore the symbol of the snake on their headdress. And in the Egyptian hieroglyphics, you can see the members of the mystery religion of Babylon in the hieroglyphics as they wore the snake on the front of their forehead. It should be evident to everybody that as an initiate, Plutarch would not have unveiled the secret meaning of the Osirian myth, and I found that to be absolutely true. No man of his priestly station or philosophic mind, who so greatly venerated the gods as to attach himself to their service, would have been guilty of the impiety of profaning their mysteries, and he would not have violated his oath of secrecy. Furthermore, had his treatise actually exposed any of the secrets of the rites, he would most probably have perished miserably, or at least been publicly disgraced. These evils not descending upon him, we must suppose that his book was regarded as harmless, and for our purpose, therefore, at least not directly informative. The second factor which gravitates against the likelihood of Plutarch's interpretations being correct is the condition of Egyptian metaphysics in the first century after Christ. If, as Budge maintains, the Egyptians themselves were unaware of the meaning of the word Osiris long prior to the Christian era, into what decay had the old rites fallen even prior to the Ptolemaic period? Now, Pluto based his accounts upon popular traditions. They were most certainly inaccurate, and it is not impossible that even the priests themselves were for the most part ignorant of the origins of their doctrine. It should not be inferred, folks, from the general literature available concerning this Osirian cycle and the mysteries that all of the priests were themselves initiates of a high order. Only a small part of them ever actually received the greater secrets of their order. For the rest, rite and ritual suffered. And it's the same today. Democritus spent a great part of his life in Egypt, and from the priests of that nation, he secured the foundation for his celebrated doctrine of atoms. That's right, folks, atoms, A-T-O-M-S. A doctrine which has survived as a scientific fact to this day. From all these different philosophers who visited Egypt, we shall secure a better estimation of the profundity of Egyptian learning than from even the Egyptian writings themselves. Plato went to Egypt and was initiated into the mysteries in the Great Pyramid, where he lay for 3 days and 3 nights in the sarcophagus, during which he was imparted knowledge which he was to guard, protect. He describes his initiation in his writings. I suggest that you read it. If we can assume the pragmatic viewpoint that the substance of matter is to be determined from its consequences, then we must indeed highly reverence the wisdom of the Egyptians. For it seems that first among the consequences of that wisdom is civilization itself. That cannot be doubted. Civilization is no fable, nor is it a progeny of myths, but that which is real and substantial. And it bears witness to a profound and superior wisdom, which must have existed over a great period of time, and have been communicated to at least a privileged few since the very beginning of man's cultural impulse. Then we can also take the example of Pythagoras, the great philosopher, while a youth, if we may credit Iamblichus, associated himself with Thales of Miletus, from whom he gained a considerable knowledge of the mysteries. Thales, being at that time of great age and infirm body, apologized for his incomplete understanding of the sacred doctrines and urged Pythagoras to visit Egypt, the motherland of wisdom, as it was called in those days. Iamblichus wrote that Thales confessed that his own reputation for wisdom was derived from the instruction of these priests, but that he was neither naturally nor by exercise endued with those excellent prerogatives which were so visibly displayed in the person of Pythagoras. Thales therefore gladly announced to Pythagoras, from all these circumstances, that he would become the wisest and most divine of all men if he associated with these Egyptian priests. Iamblichus then describes the journey which Pythagoras made to Egypt, how en route he was initiated into the mysteries of several nations, and at last, arriving at his destination, was received by the Egyptian priests with respect and affection. He associated with the Egyptian philosophers for some time, and after demonstrating by his sincerity and consecration that he was worthy to associate with the initiated, he was at last admitted into the secrets of their orders. Quote, "He spent therefore," observes Iamblichus, 22 years in Egypt, in the adyta of temples, astronomizing and geometrizing, and was initiated, not in a superficial or casual manner, in all the mysteries of the gods. Pythagoras must be acknowledged among the first of those divine men to whom the race is indebted for the principles of science, art, and philosophy. And are we to presume that so noble an intellect could have spent 22 years pursuing fabulous shadows in Egyptian crypts? If, as some have asserted, Osiris signified merely the Nile, and Isis the black earth rendered fertile by its inundation, could such a fable have so greatly stimulated the admiration of Pythagoras that he would have spent a score of years in the assimilation of the idea? I don't think so. Or again, would he have spent this great length of time, the very best years of his life, in memorizing the myth-encrusted history of an ancient king who at some remote period had reigned in Egypt and whose memory seemed sufficient to inspire a vast civilization for some 6,000 years? By the way, that's the exact number of years in the calendar of the Mystery School and of the Freemasons. Or would he approach the matter from another of these explanations? Would Pythagoras have pounded himself for a score of years against the walls of Memphis and find himself fully rewarded by being informed with bated breath by some archai magus that Isis is the dog star? I think not. It's not impossible that in the course of its long and illustrious history, folks, Egypt devised many opinions relative to her sacred myths, but no such explanation has involved Egypt alone, her histories, her heroes, or her agricultural problems, could have caused illustrious men from all parts of the world to have visited her in quest of essential wisdom, the central core of which is the myth of Osiris, Isis, and Horus, known as the Osirian cycle. The Nile meant nothing to the Greeks, who cared little whether it rose or fell. The sneezing you hear in the background is my dog, Sugar Bear, who always accompanies me into the studio to do these programs. Not Egypt, but the Umbos of Delphi was the center of their universe in Greece, and local fables derived from Egypt's 42 gnomes could never have won for the double empire its illustrious reputation as patron of all learning, human and divine. So we must look deeper. And look deeper we did, folks, And what we found is amazing. For we found that Osiris and Isis and Horus were not ever meant to be, nor were they ever real people or real gods or spacemen who came from some other world. Not at all. As we have found in our research, and as I have found in my over 20-some-odd years of research into the mystery schools, they are like all the other symbols of the mystery religion. For the public, for the profane, they are the exoteric, and you may make of them what you wish. The adepts, the initiates, the priests, they don't care what interpretation you give the exoteric meaning. And the esoteric is so entirely different from what you may suspect that the answer will surprise you. You see, we cannot be deceived by the obvious, and you can never be deceived by the obvious or even consider the obvious when looking at any of the mystery religions or the secret doctrine. And we cannot allow ourselves to be misdirected by the evident subterfuges, the deceptions of these ancient priests who so carefully concealed their arcana from the uninitiated world that we, at this late time, may even doubt its existence. Yet now, today, it is thriving to the point that it controls all levels of our society, military, and government. The ignorant, the sheeple, even among the Egyptians, might derive their inspiration from the processionals and rituals of the state religion, but that's just for the sheeple. For those great philosophers who came from afar were in search of the highest form of human knowledge, the ancient arts, the secrets of the ages, and could not be satisfied by such outer show. Had these fables been but hollow and unsubstantial forms, Egypt would have been the ridicule of the wise, who would speedily have exposed her sham and reduced her vain pretense to a humble state. But this did not occur. You see, the initiates of her mysteries, returning to their own countries, not only felt themselves more than repaid for their hazardous journeys and long vigils, but furthermore, they became founders of distinguished systems of thinking, disseminators of useful knowledge, and in all cases bore witness to a broad and deep learning. And they always took with them a plan. A plan for the unfoldment of a world utopian government, which plan still exists today and is still being carried out in secret as the completion of the great work. Diodorus describes two famous columns erected near Nysa in Arabia, one to Isis and the other to Osiris. Now remember, Osiris and Isis never lived, they were not real people, and they were never gods. They are symbols for something much deeper. So when you listen to the interpretation of the inscriptions on the columns, remember that. The column to Isis bears this inscription, quote, "I am Isis, queen of this country. I was instructed by Mercury. No one can destroy the laws which I have established. I am the eldest daughter of Saturn, the most ancient of gods. I am the wife and sister of Osiris the king. I first made known to mortals the use of wheat. I am the mother of Horus the king. In my honor was the city of Bubastis built. Rejoice, O Egypt, rejoice, land that gave me birth." Unquote. The column to Osiris bore these words, quote, "I am Osiris the king, who led my armies into all parts of the world, to the most thickly inhabited countries of India, the north, the Danube, and the ocean. I am the eldest son of Saturn. I was born of a brilliant and magnificent egg, and my substance is of the same nature as that which composes light. There is no place in the universe where I have not appeared to bestow my benefits and make known my discoveries." Unquote. And the rest of the inscription, of course, was destroyed. Now, while the inscription on the pillar, or the obelisk in honor of Isis, may be veiled, the inscription on the obelisk dedicated to Osiris is certainly not. He was born of a brilliant and magnificent egg, and his substance is of the same nature of that which composes light. There is no place in the universe where I have not appeared. Osiris, of course, was the sun. In examining Plutarch's treatise, the introductory remarks appear of special significance. Yet, folks, these remarks are wholly ignored by Egyptologists who are content to confine themselves entirely to the fable, which constitutes the larger part of the writing. If Plutarch, by any word or symbol, reveals even a small part of the sacred mystery, it is to be found in the following words, quote, "For Isis, according to the Greek interpretation of the word, signifies knowledge, as does the name of her professed adversary, Typhon, signify insolence and pride. A name, therefore, extremely well adapted to one who, full of ignorance and error, tears in pieces and conceals that holy doctrine which the goddess collects, compiles, and delivers to those who aspire after the most perfect participation of the divine nature." Now, if you have a keen intellect, you can all decipher everything else that I'm going to tell you on this program and probably the next one in that short paragraph. And I'll let you ponder that as I continue. Osiris, the black god of the Nile, must be regarded as the personification of an order of learning. For Plutarch identifies him beyond question with the holy doctrine or the mystery tradition. Now remember I told you Osiris is the symbol of the sun, but the sun was the symbol of the power of the all-encompassing God of the universe, and later you're going to learn that the light or the sun represents something even deeper. It represents, dear listeners, primordial knowing, the gift of intellect. And where people can read these myths and think that these people really worship the sun or some god somewhere, they are mistaken. For the true object of their worship is the intellect. And through the use of that intellect, they believe that man will become God. As Thoth personifies the whole sphere of knowledge, and it was through his assistance that Osiris came into being, so Osiris embodies the secret and sacred wisdom reserved for those who were proficients in the ancient rites. Unquestionably, Osiris was later confused with other members of that vast pantheon of divinities which developed in the decadent period of Egyptian religious culture, but to the elect, the initiate, the adept, the priest, he represented to the end primordial knowing, that utter realization of truth, undefiled by intellection, unlimited by any mortal procedure, uncircumscribed by the limitation of thinking. You see, he signified not only that divine at-one-ment with the absolute, which is the end of all illumination, but by his life, death, and resurrection, revealed the means by which mortal consciousness could achieve that end. Now remember, at-one-ment. Thus Osiris becomes a dual symbol, being in the first place the esoteric wisdom. Esoteric, folks, means hidden. So he represented, in the first place, the esoteric wisdom itself, and in the second place, the composite order of initiates through whom that tradition was perpetuated. And now we begin to strip the veil from the mysteries. The personality of Osiris thus typifies the institution erected by the ancients to perpetuate the deathless truths of the soul. The living head was crowned with the plumes of wisdom and power. The hands bore the scepters of the three worlds, but the body was bound with the mummy wrappings of the dead. Here we find spirit, the living head, bound incongruously to matter, the mummified body. The soul was imprisoned in the narrow bonds of flesh, One thing, through my research, is certain. Osiris represented the secret doctrine prior to that time when the omnific word, or the lost word, of Freemasonry was lost. Osiris is the first of the five children of Nut. And here you begin to part some more veils behind which the mystery resides. He therefore corresponds with the first of the five divine kings of China and the five exoterically known Dhyana Buddhas of Lamaism. The five children of Nut are the five continents which have appeared upon the earth and the five races which have populated these continents. Osiris is the primitive revelation of the first race. But as Isis was born upon the fourth day, we find this tradition coming into Egypt through the Atlantean mystery school, of which Isis is the symbol, and you will find at the base of all of these things Atlantis. Francis Bacon wrote about Atlantis. Hitler believed in Atlantis. In this country, the Freemasons established the city of Atlanta as the new Atlantis. And all of this will come together for you. It took me many, many, many years of study deep into the night and trying to discuss this with other people who had no idea what I was talking about. So most of it was put together in loneliness late at night. Then, when I established my organization known as the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence, many others begin to help and furnish bits and pieces of information. And we have succeeded, folks, in infiltrating the lodge. We have members in the lodge who feed us information constantly. Members whom we taught how to take an oath so that the oath of Freemasonry would not be binding upon them. You have to play sometimes by the rules of the enemy in order to beat the enemy. And we are beating the enemy now. From the reign of Osiris, we glean the following philosophical history. They believe that there was a time, the Golden Age, when truth and wisdom ruled the earth, and this aristocracy of wisdom was a benevolent despotism, and that's what they want to reestablish. Benevolent to who? That's the question. In which men were led to a nobler state of being by the firm, kindly hand of the enlightened sage. This was the divine dynasty of the mythological priest kings who were qualified to govern humanity by virtue, not only temporal, but by divine attributes. Through his priests, Osiris, representative of the hidden tradition, ruled the entire world by virtue of the perfection resident in that tradition. Don't miss tomorrow night, folks. You have not even begun your journey. Good night, and God bless each and every one of you.